Baldassaro interviewing Ned Colletti by telephone, December 14th, 2016.
First, I'd like you to talk a little bit about your family background, your Italian heritage, and then we'll get into, you know, how you came to be involved in baseball.
Okay. So, my grandparents came from Palermo, Sicily, and they came at the turn of the last century. Luigi Colletti.
I started
to fall in love with baseball at about 5 or 6 years old. one brother. He was born when I was six. His name is Doug. He's a banker in the city of Chicago. He's also been doing statistics and spotting for the Chicago Bears for 30-plus years. We've spent almost 70 years in professional sports, baseball, and football.
Right.
Between the two boys.
So
I started to fall in love with baseball. I went to my first game on April 15th, 1961. The Milwaukee Braves played at Wrigley Field. And some of the players in that lineup for the Braves were Matthews and Aaron. And for the Cubs was William Santo Banks. Some of you became my dear friends in the game. Don Zimmer played in that game for the Cubs.
Sure.
And the game ended on a walk-off grand slam by Al Heist, H-E-I-S-T. Center field, and then a walk-off grand slam, and it comes from 1-9-5. I still remember that most of that game vividly.
Sure.
That was about to, the next day I would turn 7 years old. So that was my first game, and I became a fanatic. I listened to the Cubs on radio every day. Vince Lloyd, Lou Bucco. I watched on television Jack Brickhouse at WGN and continued to watch the game and started to really love the game. In 1968, 69, and 70, I was 14, 15, 16 years old. I started to go to games and really build on myself. And my buddies would go once in a while, but they didn't necessarily have the passion I did. So I took a train on the Milwaukee Road, ran right to Franklin Park. It was about 2 blocks from the train station, so I took the train down to the Narragansett Street exit station, took that bus down to Addison Street, and then took the Addison Street down to Wrigley. I probably went 40 games a year, almost every day in the summer when they were home. I went, it cost me a good day, and they would give me $3 on a day when things were tight, he'd give me $2. And that was the price for the day. When I first started going to Wrigley Field, the bleacher seats were 60 cents, and they were 75 cents. They were $1, $1.50, $3. But that's when I started to really look into the game on a serious level. And I was sick. I get there early. I get there about 10 o'clock. They used to open the gates at 10:15, 10:20. You had about 3 hours before the game started. Well, I was there many bowls before anybody had taken the field, so I would sit in the first row of the left field bleachers as far over the center field as I could reach. And most of the days I sat there, I did it by myself because nobody wanted to go as much as I did. Nobody had the passion, I guess, that I did. So I could have many days as I could have wanted to do it. And I'd sit there, and the Cubs would come up and start getting loose and start taking BP, and so I started to know some of them as a young kid and ask questions. I would watch the game, and I almost had a few of us at the camp, and as you could see the life on a fastball, you could see the break of a curveball or a slider or a change of speed on the change. And you could see that, you could see how the infield is played and the outfield is played in the whole game in front of you. Reminded him that I had met him years earlier when I was a little kid, and
saying anything. So I played three sports. I played baseball, I played ice hockey, and I played soccer. And, of course, in the Midwest, you know, the kids in the West now where I live, you see them playing baseball more than once a year. Obviously, in Chicago, it's a little bit, it's not a little bit harder than that. It's impossible.
Industrial. None of the dads that I, my buddies, went to work with.
would go to a student's eye.
Yeah.
It was all labor. It was all factory.
Yep.
And so, in September, we bought a house in October, my wife gives birth. And in December, I lose the job. So now we're making about $30,000 combined, and now it turns into nothing. Okay. And at the time, you know, I was a new dad. My son was about 5 weeks, 6 weeks old when the paper folded. My dad had really gotten a lot sicker. He was in the hospital. My mom was taking the same train to the same stop that I got off to go to Wrigley. She got off and went to the hospital. And so all this, you know, there was a lot of difficult times going on. So I'm not sure what I was going to do. And luckily, I got a blessing from Bob Ibach, I-B-A-C-H. Bob had worked at the Philadelphia Journal with me. He had actually covered the Flyers before me. And he knew that my dad was sick. He knew that the paper had folded. He also knew I was from Chicago. He knew I was a new dad. So he called me in the office. Job with the Cubs. He says, we have two jobs here. Both of them paid $13,000. You can interview for either one of them or both of them. One is a publications job and the other is a media relations job. And I thought about it and I talked to my dad and he says, you can't come back here for $13,000. You're a young father. You have a mortgage. Your mortgage is going to eat up almost all of that money because of the 18% interest rate. So I thought about it for a few more days, and I was talking to my dad and my mom every day, and my dad did ask me, he said, if there's a way for you to get home, you should get home. So I called the Cubs, and I talked to them, and I said, you know, I'd like you to consider something else. I'd like you to give me $1,000 to move and $15,000 for a job, and I'll do both jobs. And they were taken aback a little bit, but said yes, because every dollar was important. My take-home pay was $1,002 a month. 501 on the first, 501 on the 15th. And my mortgage was in the 700s. So I had $200 left for a month. I went back to Chicago. I was living in my in-law's basement. And had a house in Philly that I had bought just weeks before, literally weeks before. So it was a bit of a trying period of time between my dad very sick and dying, being a new dad, losing a job, having to start a new job, having to move back, having to look out for my mom and help her out. My mom and dad were in love with each other's life. The issue my brother was good that he could continue to go in school. I had a lot of things going on at one time. So, as the blessings of life would have it, I started with the Cubs on January 3rd, 1982. My dad dies on April 27th, 1982. One of my sorrows is that he and I never got to go to a game when I was working there. He obviously went to games when I was growing up, but he never actually got to go with me when I was an employee of the team that he grew up rooting for and had a lot of his brothers. So I did that for 3 years, and at the end of the year, I was somebody because of my dad's work ethic. I never took a day of work for granted, and I never sloughed off. I was living in Sherman Park, which is where my in-laws were at, next to Franklin Park, and it was about a 20-mile ride to Wrigley Field. And it was not an easy ride. There was no highway that really took you there. It was going down city streets from it wasn't another 20 miles, but it was probably 90 to 100 blocks, so maybe 12 miles. And I was told, well, you got a stoplight. But undeterred, I just figured out how I was going to make the most of it. And I was always the first one there and the last one out, and I made myself made it known that I would take any responsibility, that I would be an honorable employee, one with integrity. And that people can trust my work and trust me. And so on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, this is also what you're looking for, right?
Yeah, sure. I want to get, you know, how you got into Major League Baseball as a GM, obviously, but this is great.
Well, I'm still moving that.
Yeah, this is great. Just right.
was there before Thanksgiving in 1984, if you know where the Cubs went to the postseason. It wasn't Dallas for the first time since 45. And Dallas Green walked by with an attorney, and he said, "I want you to meet Frank Casey." He's an attorney with a big firm in Washington, D.C. He's going to be doing his daily arbitration work. And I'd like you to help him out. You know, you've been traveling with the team. You know the game. You played the game. You and we can be good for Frank to give him all of the insight into our arbitration eligible players. So we had one player who went to a hearing, which was Leon Durham, our first baseman. And we prevailed in the hearing. And Dallas was very pleased with that. And the Dallas Green came back and said, "Can you give him more responsibility, including I got to increase his salary." So I stayed with the Cubs. I started to do, he was very good about giving me other experiences. Scouting, player development, and negotiation of contracts, and a lot of different things. He really, really opened the door for a lot of things. And I was still in the media relations and publications area, but little by little, I kind of left that for the baseball operations area.
Yeah.
And I stayed there for 13 years, and I left the Cubs in 1993. By 1995, and I went to the San Francisco Giants. I worked there for 2 years as a director of baseball operations under Bob Quinn, whose son is the CFO for the Bruins.
Yeah, yes.
Bob Quinn, and his dad was my GM in San Fran, and Brian Sirmium was the assistant GM. So 2 years went by, and Bob retired, and Brian moved up to GM. I moved up to assistant GM. My career then really started to flourish. Brian Sabin is one of the greatest GMs in baseball in the state, the smartest people I've been around, and also somebody who was not territorial or insecure with his own skill set. So we did a lot of things. I had a lot of opportunities that most assistant GMs never have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made trades. I did all the signings, all the negotiations. And Brian and I and Dick Tidrow, who was still there, was a selling director at the time of player development. The three of us kind of helped that team and molded it from a team that was in Candlestick Park and helped to move to Tampa the year before we arrived. Mm-hmm. It ended up staying there and thriving in San Francisco to the point that a new stadium opened in 2000, Petco Park,
yep.
Now AT&T Park, and they draw 3 million fans year after year after year. So we had good players there. We went out, we were kind of on the road to build a culture and build a team. And of course, we had Barry Bonds and Matt Williams together, and we had to trade one or the other because of the payroll and because of the sagging attendance at Candlestick. So we traded Matt Williams for Jeff Captain, Jose Biscayeno, and Julio Tavares, a full-aid pitcher named Joe Mora. And then we signed Darrell Hamilton, and then we signed Doug Henry. We had Captain Biscayeno with the Williams deal. We traded with Anaheim for J.P. Snow. And suddenly we went from a team that was losing 90 games a year to a team that started winning 90 games a year.
Yep.
So we went to our first year as a GM for Saints and assistant GM for me was 97. We went to the postseason the first year and got beat by Florida on their way to the World Championship. 98, we played a 163rd game against the Cubs. Playoff game, we were tied. We got beat at Wrigley Field. 99, we lost by a considerable margin, but had a decent year. 2000, we won again. 2001, we had Bonds hitting 73 home runs. We got eliminated the next to the last day of the season. 2002, under the wild card team, went to the World Series. Got beaten 7 games by Anaheim. 2003, we went back to the playoffs, got beat by Florida again. They went on to win again. And this went on and on. And then in 2005, I moved on to the Dodgers. And I had opportunities to interview with a couple other clubs previously, but my heart really wasn't in leaving San Francisco just to say I was going to become a general manager.
Mm-hmm.
I love my living there, I love working there, and Sabin and I are like brothers. So it needed to be something good. And in November of 2005, Frank McCourt called Dan O'Dowd, sought permission to talk to me. Peter and I talked about it. He was very reluctant to give me the permission, although he knew that he really needed to give me an opportunity. So we talked about that one night at length, and then he allowed me to go interview with the doctors about 8 days later. I think he was trying to put as much care in it as possible, so maybe Frank McLeod would move on to somebody else at that point. The weather was already November. And so I went to the general manager's meetings in Palm Springs with Brian and Dick Tidrow. And as soon as they were over, I moved on to, I drove up to Beverly Hills. And I met with Frank McCord on a Friday at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And I met with him Friday. I went back to San Francisco Saturday and Sunday. And on Monday, he called me back for another 2 days of interviews, offering me the job as general manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. So I obviously took that opportunity, and did that from November 15th of 2005 until October 14th to 15th of 2014, when I was replaced in the general manager's role, and I became a special advisor to a senior advisor to Sandcast, and I started doing a lot of TV work. I fell into a lot of scouting for the amateur draft. And when I was helping in the transition, the majority of what I did for the Dodgers since then has been done.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, I thought I lost you there.
So, that's what, that's about 40 years of professional work kind of spread out over 10 minutes.
Yes. How would you describe your style as a GM?
Well, I think I try to always look for players of character.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever 100% successful because you're dealing with the human element of people. Whether it's yourself, whether it's players, or there's just too many factors that lead into being perfect with what you do. I don't look for character. I look for people you could quote trust. I don't mean to watch your house. I mean to be trusted to do everything they could do to win.
Yeah.
And no matter what they made that day, you can make a $10 million or you can make a $10, you were going to give everything they had. So I always draw the players like that. I would take a player on a scale from 1 to 10. If there was a player with a 10 ability, but a 3 character, right? A player with a 7 ability, with a 10 character, I take the 10, the 7, and 10 all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so now I think that was it. I think I learned a lot about patience. I learned a lot about expectation. I learned a lot about people. I learned a lot about myself. I think, it's one of those jobs that really lends itself to such a vast view of the sport that you love, but it's also a sport that has people. So
right.
You have a lot of different challenges that come with managing people.
Yep.
And part of our strength in San Francisco was the relationship that I had with Brian and that both of us had with Dick Tidrow. Hmm. And when I went to L.A., I was void of that. I did not have that. Hmm. I didn't have me sitting next to me, helping me, so to speak.
Yeah.
I've missed that. So it became, it was a struggle. It was a struggle for a while until the staff and I started to get on the same page, and I had to make a couple changes and then present some people to the point. And after I got to know that, it was one of the toughest roles I had, was really transitioning and starting building a different culture. The Giants culture, which is still alive and rich today, has become one of the best in Major League Baseball for 20 years now.
Yep.
And they had a couple off years right after I left. But by and large, they've had a very, very strong culture there. And I tried to recreate it in LA, and I was not able to really get it all the way there.
Hmm.
And that's a people issue as much as anything. And of course, I'm the boss, so it fell to me to try and manage it. So, I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Yeah, you would say your greatest challenge then was the transition to L.A. and getting things in place.
Well, my greatest challenge, I think, was developing a culture that I don't even they're directly responsible for the one loss record.
Yep.
But you're directly responsible for them. And so, you know, you can't just go to the department store or the warehouse and pick out a new set of fender or a new shortstop or an enclosure, you know. I mean, you can't do that. So, you know, you have to build it and you have to hope that you're building it with the right types of people. The team I inherited was 71 and 91.
Yep.
It was the second poorest record in the history of the LA part of the franchise.
Yep.
So I would start from a pretty low spot. But we turned it immediately. I signed some players that I knew that had the right character. Kenny Lofton, Noel Garcia Parra, Rafael Falcao, Danny Miller. Right off out of the gate, we signed some people that I thought could help us get better quick. We also had Jeff Kent there and J.D. Drew and Derek Lowe, Brad Benny. Eric Gagne was banged up. Jeff Weaver left as a free agent. So we had a lot of work to do when I took over, which was November 15th. We're already 6 weeks in. We did not have a manager. We did not have a coaching staff. I had a staff that I really didn't know. And some of them were probably upset that somebody from the Giants and stuff into a role of Rodgers.
Right.
But that was probably the grade. And we won. First year in 06, we went to the postseason.
Yep.
So we turned 71-91, I think we won 88, maybe, and ended up going to the first round and got beat by the Mets. And then 07, a bit of an uneven year. We had a lot of veterans, but we also had a lot of young players, and the team really didn't see eye to eye, so we had a little bit of disharmony in the room. Then in 08 and 09, we went to the LCS back-to-back years. So, won three of my first 4 years there, and ended up going back to the playoffs again in 13 and 14 to the LCS in 13, division in 14, and the last couple of teams, broadcasting. But there's some players left on the 15 team and the 16 team that won divisions, and the 16 team obviously got to the LCS. So, in my 11 years there, we've had 7 teams go to the playoffs, and 4 of them go to the LCS, still waiting to go to the Fall Classic.
Yeah. Of course, in 2008, you hired Joe Torre as manager.
Yes. I hired Joe. I worked with Joe for 3 years. It was great to work with Joe. Joe's a very, very smart guy. Brooklyn-born, played baseball his whole life, variety of different roles. Hall of Fame manager.
Really?
Great player, too. Very good player.
Yep.
Really.
People forget that.
Well, yeah. MVP in the league and somebody that really was a very good player, not a Hall of Fame player probably, but then when he became the manager that he did, that the Hall of Fame was a natural as a manager slash player inductee. And so it was great working with Joe. I think we had a great relationship. We went through a lot of trying times with ownership. His ownership was going through a long period of time. But we stuck together. After 3 years, Joe wanted to retire. I worked in the commissioner's office, so Joe left. And I hired Don Mattingly, and Don did a nice job as a first-year manager, but we were going through all sorts of turmoil financially with the ownership, so I wanted to hire somebody who I believed in and who I trusted, and who would work for an opening wage, because it was the first time we ever managed. So I paid Donnie for that, and I knew Donnie was going to work very hard, one of the hardest-working guys I know, and somebody that I'm proud to be associated with everybody. You know, Grady Little was my first, and then Joe and then Donnie. You know, all of them were class acts and just great baseball men and people that, you know, I hope, because I know they also helped me.
Yeah. You said you focused as a GM on character. What about the role of analytics, which has become so prevalent now, I think, at that level? How did you approach that?
Well, people view me as a old school scout.
I've heard that, yes.
But the truth of it is, when I started working for the Cubs, I started doing analytics before anybody really even had a computer to use.
Mm-hmm.
And Jimmy Fly, who was our manager there starting in 1984, had been a coach for Weaver in Baltimore.
Yep.
And so Jimmy's first step over there, he goes to me and he
says, hey, I need you to do something. It's going to be hard because you probably haven't got this already done. So it may be hard for you. It's going to take you some time. But I need you to give me hard players who would run as a strong position. How do you play the game? How do you hit against lefties, against righties, home, road? And I need you to give me matchups. I need them on an index card every day. Our starting pitchers with the other teams. And vice versa. And so I spent the winter of 83, 84 just going through box score after box score all by hand. And so we started the system. And we started using what you would consider, elementary analytics at this point. But we started doing it. And we did it by hand. And the Tribune Company owned the Cubs. And so they were interested in doing it. In the workplace and in homes and offices, they, Tribune Company and myself, started to develop an analytics program. Taken from the stuff that I was doing by hand, along with many other things. And so we did that. So my career was really, the advances I was able to make in my career were really due to analytics. They were due to hard work and loyalty and being something that Dallas could count on. But then it also due to my ability to want to know what the numbers said. And so I've used analytics my whole career. I never felt it necessary to explain my process. So people kind of, without knowing me, will pigeonhole me as, because I've been around 35 years where he doesn't care about analytics. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm never gonna forget that there's a person inside that uniform.
Something important, as you say, about character, and you see that again and again.
Anybody in a leadership position, information's king. So you need all information. You need every piece of information, including analytics, but including scouting reports. You need reports on who is this guy. I would talk to people who most people might not even put the same value. When I would talk about signing a free agent player or retaining a free agent player, I would talk to our media relations people. I would talk to our trainer, our traveling secretary. Those three groups know the player better than anybody. And also a visiting player, I would go to the visiting clubhouse manager, especially as a National League player. Just think about it. He sees that player maybe 9 times a year, maybe 3 times a year. Maybe he's seen him for years, and he sees what time he comes to the park, and he sees how he prepares, and he sees how he treats people in the clubhouse. Because you got a lot of young people working there, making minimum wage. How do you treat people? How does the manager of him relate? How does he relate to his teammates? Because in the clubhouse, most people think nobody's watching. So, I would ask a visiting clubhouse guy many times, give me a lowdown on this guy. And visiting clubhouse guys I worked with were always attuned to the human element. Before I didn't talk to you, too, they were just attuned because that's what they do.
That's what they do.
They would help me all the time.
and said, this is a good guy. His teammates don't like him. He's able to see game, and he can't wait to get out of the clubhouse. He doesn't treat the young guys good. You know, the clubhouse kids. Mm-hmm. Even the manager always going through a tough time. Or he says, this guy puts it all on the field day after day. He's a leader. He's there early. He takes care of the clubhouse kids. He takes care of the rookies on the team. He'll call a guy over. He sees it all. And so I would use that aspect of it too. When you get into a season, there's no sport as all consuming as baseball.
No, absolutely.
And there's no disrespect to the other sport. When you play 162 days games and 183 days, we're going to expand that to the CBA a little bit more days. But you only got 21 days off.
Yep.
And in those 21 days, you're traveling. If you're a West Coast team, you're traveling 12 of them, minimum, maybe 15 of them.
Yeah.
And so you never get that break. Unless you get sent down or you're hurt, hang out, you know. But you never get that break. So it's a constant from Valentine's show, if you're fortunate, to Halloween.
Yeah.
And that's a long period of time
to
deal with, to deal with your teammates and your fellow workers.
Yeah.
And so you better know who they are. Because if you don't, the chance of being successful, not strong.
Yeah. You talked about Torrey and some others. Are there other, whether they're players or others, that stick out in your mind, both with the Giants and the Dodgers?
Yeah, and the Cubs. I think the smartest, I'll go with guys who are really super impressive to me, that's performers. I was with Greg Maddux when he was drafted and when he made his debut in the first 6 years of his contract.
Right.
And then I truly informed twice. For the history of Greg Maddux, he was treated twice. Both times I trained for him.
I know that.
And he is the best. He is a genius at his draft. He saw it different than everybody. He could slow it down. I think the greatest athletes can slow a game down. Between watching a movie and seeing it frame by frame by frame by frame.
Yeah, yeah. I loved watching him. It was like watching a surgeon, operate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What precision?
I think Greg was the most, it was genius in what he did, right behind him, Zach Greinke.
Yeah, sure.
Also, tremendous feel for the game and for the craft.
Hmm.
The best. And then on the hitting side, Barry Bonds was the ultimate player. Speed, defense, power. Great hitter, great mind, tremendous mind. He may not have known all the names of the national pitchers, but he never forgot a release point. He never forgot what the pitcher had tried to do to him, what he was capable of doing. He was the best. And right behind him was Manny Ramirez.
Manny.
Right side.
Yeah.
He worked hard. They worked tirelessly. They worked at the fine points of their craft. And two of the best hitters, two of the best pitchers, one of the best baseball players I was ever around was Omar Vizquel, who decided to San Francisco.
Sure.
Another guy who used every facet of his ability to become successful. He is not a big man, but look it up. This man was within a year or so of 3,000 hits.
Yep.
Think about how hard that is when the outfield is probably playing 100 feet back of the infield.
Right.
But he was another guy who pitched so flawlessly and so intelligently. And so those are probably my five that stand out as just exceptional minds and talents. So many guys in the game I consider friends, and I was honored around. I mean, the list is very, very long of that. Sandberg, Sutcliffe, Billy Williams, Ernie Banks, Santa, who I worked with, all those guys around the Cubs when I went to work there. Ferguson, Jenkins, Giants, Willie Mays, and Juan Marichal, and McCovey, who I got to see all the time at the ballpark. And of course, I said Bonds and Jeff Kent, who played hard every day. Nothing was so Jeff Kent from playing hard. Kirk Reeder, few got more out of his ability than Kirk Reeder did. A winning guy. 1995-96, he just worked at his craft. There's the slow guys. There's so many that. Justin turned around with the Dodgers, decided to pick the Kelly Johnson, of course, Clayton. Corey Seager. As I look at the next generation of players, I was a GM when we drafted Seager. I was a GM when we drafted Kershaw. Both these players have a force. Obviously, Seager's major league career is just beginning. Kershaw's is still probably the first half. End of the first half, closing in, but both of these players are Hall of Fame caliber, not only players, but people. This is a list that I don't think you can portray. This is not the entire list. This is like off the top of my head list, because there's 35 years, I've probably been around 1,000 different players.
Sure.
And very few would make the list.
Oh, gosh. Yep. Now, I think you weren't with the Giants when Dave Righetti went there, were you?
Yes, not as a player, but as a coach.
Yeah. Yeah, Dave is another guy I've gotten to know pretty well, and talk about character. As far as I'm concerned, he's one of the best.
One of my favorite people.
Yeah?
One of my absolute favorite people.
Yeah.
He was, he's been there a long time. He was a pitching coach, one of the better ones in the game, but just a good guy.
Yes.
It's funny because you go back. I don't know if this is interesting or not, but it's interesting to me. It's just kind of a, when I think of Righetti, when I was growing up, my uncles and my cousins or, my buddies or my dad, they called me Neddy.
Mm-hmm.
Right? N-E-D-D-I-E.
Mm-hmm.
The only guy in Major League Baseball in 35 years that ever called me that was Rex.
Really?
Hey, Neddy, how you doing? It's like the old Italian thing,
So did you relate to him or even others as Italians?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think there's always that threat that ties you together. You talk about where you grew up and some of the things you did as a kid and things like that, yeah, no doubt.
So you would say that you definitely do identify as an Italian-American?
Oh, I'm tremendously proud of it.
Yeah,
tremendously proud of it. A few years ago, I was inducted into the Italian American National Sports Hall of Fame in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, George.
That's how you got a hold of me. It was one of the greatest honors of my life.
Yeah.
And they had a dinner the night. There was a dinner on Friday night. It took place a mile from where my dad grew up.
Oh, nice.
And the induction the next night on Saturday took off. Oh, it was a mile from where I grew up.
That's cool.
So, very, very, very special.
So just to sum up, what would you say that overall baseball has meant to you in your life?
Well, it has provided me as a fan some of the greatest moments as a fan, as a observer of the game, including the last World Series.
Mm-hmm.
It's given me great joy as a recreation. And it's provided a living for myself and my family. Again, where I come from, you're not expected to be in Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
You're not expected to be the general manager of one of the most iconic franchises in the game.
Right.
And that I was able to do that, it'll never be lost on me how unique and special and blessed I've been.
Mm.
When I was growing up, I had hoped to have a mortgage and not rent. And if I was fortunate enough to have kids, I could be able to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
I had two adult kids that had master's degrees, and they're tremendous young people. They've had great things happen in their life and their career, and I've been able to buy a place and not have to rent.
Nice.
So my simple goals were met really because of hard work and opportunity, and although I never really had a sponsor who said, hire Ned Coletti's son. My dad, I'm a junior, my dad was a senior. I never had that, but I had people like Dallas Green, Bob Ivock and Dallas Green, and then Bob Quinn and Sabian, and then Frank McCoy at the Dodgers and Sam Cass. Give me an opportunity.
Yeah, that's all you can ask.
Still going with it all the way,
Yeah.
So baseball's it's not something I ever take for granted.
Yeah.
And I when the season ends, I'm typically exhausted, I'm mentally tired, I'm physically tired, and about a week later, I can't wait for
can't wait.